Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 139. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a couple of movies which are kind of police procedurals, but with a horror bent to them. The first one is from 1980, and it is the classic movie Alligator, starring Robert Forster. And then I move on to 1984 for the movie Runaway, starring Tom Selleck and Gene Simmons, the one from Kiss and not the female actor who was in Spartacus. But basically police procedurals, one in the near future, one very much in 1980. So I'm going to get the contact details out of the way and we can start talking about amphibians and robots. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Hey, how the hell is everybody? I've been to the gym, so I'm full of piss and vinegar. Welcome to Martian Driving Podcast. So, how has life been in the last 2 weeks? I've been getting very much into Japan because of the holiday, which is still 8 months away, that Sal and I are going to take to Tokyo, Osaka, and Hiroshima. So, I've been doing a lot of Japanese stuff. I've been reading manga. I've been watching anime. I've been doing all sorts of stuff like that. It's a bit of an ID fix for me at the moment. But I'm enjoying the learning curve of kind of catching up on Japanese pop culture, which I dabbled in the 1960s with Astro Boy and Prince Planet and Marine Boy, Phantom Agents, Shintaro the Samurai, all that kind of stuff. And then I dabbled in the 80s with Urusei Yatsura and Ranma Half and all sorts of things like that. And so now I'm getting back into it. So here's my theory. Every 20 or 30 years, I go into a mania about Japanese pop culture. So I'm deeply looking forward in my 80s to be really kind of hanging out with whatever Japanese pop culture is in the 2040s. So there we go. It's going to be an interesting time. So really enjoying that, anticipating the holiday. We haven't had an overseas holiday in over a decade. It's easier for other people because most of you people in other countries can just drive to another country. For us, it's a little more of an ask to go overseas. You've got to cross water to travel to another country here. It's pretty deep water as well. So, yeah, looking forward to that. Got the passport finally, and with that passport photo that makes you look like you've been traveling for 12 hours in an aluminium tube. And also, up there with passport photos, here's the thing. Passport photos are meant to look like your corpse because that's basically what they're there for. If the plane crashes, they've got to identify you somehow. And the passport photo is going to look like you're going to look when your plane has totally smashed up on the off chance that your face doesn't get destroyed in the offing. The other thing is that Australian passports are crazily expensive, about $300 almost to get an Australian passport. I believe they're a lot more cheaper if they're legal. But I paid $300 for mine. Anyway, that's been going on. I've still got to pay for bullet train tickets between the cities, but everything else is paid for at the moment, which is kind of nice. Anyway, it is time for...
What has Terry been watching?
Surprisingly enough, I've been watching a bit of anime. And the one that I've been watching after I finished One Punch Man, which I recommend highly, is a recommendation from friend of the podcast, Greg Tannehill, who recommended The Devil is a Part-Timer, which is a kind of cute anime. The demon lord Satan in another world, the world's called Enter Isla, gets confronted by some heroes and escapes to our world with his assistant Alciel. Unfortunately, when he gets to our world, he only has a tiny bit of magic and he is transmogrified into what he would be like as a human being. And he's in modern Japan. And because of this, he doesn't have much magic. He's in modern Japan. And so he gets a job as a part-timer in a McDonald's restaurant. That's the setup. So basically, this all-powerful satanic figure ends up working as a part-timer in a fast food restaurant. It's kind of cool and kind of cute. I love the idea. I'm about two episodes in, and I'm enjoying The Devil as a Part-Timer. So thanks for that one, Greg. I will update you when I've watched some more episodes, but at this stage, I'm hooked, and I think I'll enjoy it. I also watched for the first time the 1977 Japanese film House, otherwise known as Houseu, which is deeply and seriously fucked up. It is a really strange and weird Japanese movie about a haunted house and an old lady and a cat and all sorts of weird and wonderful shit. I was going to do it for the podcast, but it's so indescribable that I'd have to do a lot of research and a lot of notes. Now, I may do it for a future one. If you want me to do it, let me know and drop some money into Patreon and I'll do it. But it's a challenging one to podcast about, given that it's in another language. And everything you could say about the movie is a spoiler. However, it's really good. I liked it. I'm going to have to watch it a time or two more to pick up everything from it. So, House is a really weird and wonderful film. We did pick up Amazon Prime. We got Amazon Prime so we could watch a few things. And it's about, you know, $5 to $7 a month. So why wouldn't you add another streaming service on at that kind of price? And I watched a Jaws ripoff from the late 70s called Tentacles, which has some interesting actors in it. It's got Bo Hopkins in it, John Huston, Henry Fonda's in it, Shirley Winters, a bunch of other people. It's not very good because it's a giant octopus that is the monster, and because they didn't have the wherewithal to really make a mechanical octopus, there's a lot of kind of weird shots of tentacles and things like that in there. It's bad. Let's just put it that way. It is pretty fucking bad. But the character actors in it are okay, and they do the thing that they actually do in Alligator, one of the movies I'm going to talk about in this podcast, and that is you get a famous old actor who's kind of close to their use-by date. You get him in to do a few scenes in a day or two, and you put a lot of those together, it looks like your movie's a lot higher budget than it really is. So there's a bit of that going on in that one. Then I went and saw, well, I didn't go and see, I brought it to me on a screen. Talladega Nights, The Legend of Ricky Bobby, the Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly movie, which is nowhere near as good as their next effort, Step Brothers, which is one of my favourite comedies over the last 20 years. It's okay. It's got Sacha Baron Cohen playing a gay Frenchman. It's got a whole bunch of other actors in it. There are a few gags that kind of work, but on the whole, it really does kind of miss rather than hit most of the marks that it's aiming at. Then I saw a short movie, which is fortunately it's short because it's really bad as well. I've been watching some bad stuff lately. And that is Catwoman on the Moon, starring Sonny Tufts, Marie Windsor and Victor Jory, which is about a mission to the moon of four astronauts. It's a kind of template for Amazon Women on the Moon in a lot of ways. And, it's bad. They've got some really ropey mechanical spiders in there. They've got a whole bunch of women on the moon with weird hairdos, big eyebrows, and black leotards, because black leotards is a perfect thing to wear on the moon, I suppose. It's from about 1953, and even though Sonny Tufts is supposed to be the mission commander of the mission, he's such a lumpy, dumb, bad actor, and also probably on the piss at the time, that Victor Jory as the second-in-command really kind of go, okay, well, why didn't they hire that guy to be the commander of the mission instead of the lump of meat that they've got there? It's an interesting piece of casting. Let's just put it that way. So that one you can find, I think, on YouTube. Either way, it's, like I said, bad. I've been watching a few bad things. But I did watch one really good thing. Sal and I have been slowly working our way through the Studio Ghibli movies. And so the next one we saw was Princess Mononoke from about 1997, I think it is. Hayao Miyazaki. There's nothing bad to say about this film. The animation is beautiful. The characters are great. And there's a wonderful ambiguity to a lot of characters. They're not good or evil. You can understand everybody's viewpoint. This is probably something that a lot of superhero movies at the moment would have used as a template, because there are no heroes and villains. They're just people with conflicting viewpoints. And it works on a whole lot of levels. It's got a lot of Japanese legends in it. It's got some beautiful, beautiful set pieces. And you like the characters. I've watched the English dub version of it, which is not bad. The voice acting is quite good on it. And this is a movie to treasure. I mean, like all of the Studio Ghibli movies, it has a lot more depth than almost any other animation you're ever going to see. And if you haven't seen Princess Mononoke, you really should. And if you haven't seen it lately, you really should revisit it. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about the wonderful 1980 giant alligator movie Alligator, directed by Lewis Teague and starring Robert Forster, Robin Riker, and Michael V. Gazzo. And here is the trailer.
It lives 50 feet beneath the streets. It's 36 feet long. It weighs over 2,000 pounds. And it's about to break out.
We're looking at the one who saw it. And it was big.
You said it was dark. Now, perhaps you were mistaken. An alligator half that size would starve in a week. No! Coming up with some garbage about alligators in the sewers.
Alligators in the sewers?
Once it escaped, there was no way to stop it.
No! No! The safety of the public is my job!
It could be anywhere.
There he is.
Ready to attack at any moment.
You know, I've seen what this animal can do. You'd better take all the help you can get.
First, no one believed it. Now, no one will forget it. Alligator.
In 1975, the movie Jaws did several things. First thing is it made a shit ton of money. Steven Spielberg got rich and became a big name. It made so much money that it was ridiculous. And the second thing it did was it invented the summer blockbuster. So summer season in the Northern Hemisphere, winter here, is the season when all the really big tentpole movies come out. And it's become an industry of its own. Literally, billions and billions of dollars have been made on summer blockbusters in the last 40 years. We're talking Jeff Bezos levels of money. So that's the second thing it did. Third thing it did was it spun out a cottage industry of monster movies with natural predators. So you got Tentacles, which I mentioned earlier, which was really bad. And about 5 years after Jaws hit it big, we have the John Sayles written movie Alligator. The setup for this one's pretty simple. A police detective, David Madison, played by Robert Forster, finds out that underneath the streets of Chicago, there is a giant alligator which is starting to eat people. That's the setup. It's as simple as that, and everything follows from there. Now, the original script for this film was kind of interesting in a fucked up and silly way. It was written by a guy called Frank Ray Perilli, and the original setup was to have the film set in Milwaukee, and the alligator became giant because of the runoff from all of the beer factories in Milwaukee. Now, this is the sort of thing that you get from the guy who was in movies as bad as Laser Blast. In fact, he wrote the really bad 1978 Charles Band movie, Laser Blast. So what John Sayles, when he came on board, as he says, he was a script carpenter for this. He ditched all of that kind of stuff and kept it simple. He wanted to do the political side of it. He wanted the cop to be a realistic guy. He wanted the love interest to be important, not just there to scream. And he wanted it to have fun and to acknowledge Jaws. There's a bit of graffiti around in the film, if you look carefully, which references Jaws. Now, they got Robert Forster, who had made an impact in 1968 in Haskell Wexler's wonderful movie, which if you haven't seen, you really should, Medium Cool. He then went on to do some TV stuff. He did a TV series called Nakia, which was really good, and a few other bits and pieces, and had been around as a jobbing actor. And it wasn't until Jackie Brown in the early 90s that he kind of had a comeback, when Tarantino, being the film buff that he is, recognised that Robert Forster is a fantastic character actor. He had a natural charm and charisma that really kind of lifted Jackie Brown and made it something special, particularly with the chemistry he had with Pam Grier in that film. And in this one, with Robin Riker, the actress playing Marissa, the herpetologist who helps him during the thing, he has that as well. There's a really kind of comfortable chemistry between the two of them, which is a little better than the movie in some ways. They play off each other really well. There's a flirtatious thing. They make fun of the male pattern baldness that Robert Forster had, rather than getting the actor to wear a toupee or something like that. They made it a part of the character, which is really, really cool. And it's Robert Forster playing honest with his own look, which a lot of actors aren't, even to this day, willing to do. But it kind of brings us closer to the character in a lot of ways. We like him because of that flaw and that slight neurosis he has about his thinning hair. We also get a whole litany of really interesting character actors in this one who come in and do a day or two's work and then piss off again. But it fills the movie out nicely. We have Michael V. Gazzo playing the police chief. He was a bald, moustached actor. He was in the second Godfather movie, amongst other things, but he started out after going through his training on the GI Bill after World War II, and he wrote a play which became a movie that wasn't all that popular, but is a really good film, a movie called A Hat Full of Rain, which is about drug addiction, which I think, if I remember correctly, and I'm running off memory here while I quickly look into IMDb, I think Ben Gazzara was in it. Let me just find out for sure, because I want to do A Hat Full of Rain in a future podcast. And let's see, A Hat Full of Rain. Dun, dun, dun. Don Murray, Eva Marie Saint, Anthony Franciosa, that's who were in it. Don Murray, Eva Marie Saint, Anthony Franciosa, Noid Lowell, Henry Silver, who's also in Alligator, oddly enough. William Hickey. Oh, geez, I've got to do this movie for Paleo Cinema soon. But anyway, Michael V. Gazzo is in it. Dean Jagger, who we remember from a lot of films in early days. He was in Bad Day at Black Rock, amongst other things. He plays Slade, who is basically bankrolling a pharmaceutical company which is testing growth hormones on stray pets, what we now call rescue dogs. He kind of experiments on them, kills them, and then dumps them into the sewers, and the chemicals get into the sewers. The chemicals then get into the alligator. The alligator then grows much larger. The guy who's selling him the dogs is a guy called Guttrill, played by character actor Sidney Lassick. He's in there as well. Comedian Jack Carter plays the mayor. Henry Silver comes in as the alligator starts chomping on various people as a kind of great white hunter type called Brock. And he's kind of interesting there, playing very, very much tongue-in-cheek. We get Bart Braverman, who I remember was in Vegas, the TV series with Robert Urich, playing a newspaper reporter who is trying to get the story and all that kind of thing. He's a very much a kind of cliche stereotype character. And then we get one of my favourite actresses from the 1970s, Angel Tompkins, who comes in briefly as a newswoman. And Angel Tompkins was a fantastic actress for a number of reasons. And she was also very, very attractive and was not unwilling to reveal her unclad form. She was also in a TV series I really like called Search. She had three different protagonists through the series. Hugh O'Brien, Tony Franciosa and Doug McClure playing in it. Very ahead of its time technologically. If I was doing a TV series podcast, I'd definitely add Search to the list because I like it. And I also have it on a box set. But Angel Tompkins is in there playing one of the technical staff. And yeah, I've got a lot of fondness for her as an actor and as a character. So seeing her in this movie was a lot of fun as well. So the alligator is under the sewers and start getting out. The city authorities don't believe it. The people really behind the scenes who are running things, Slade, doesn't want this getting out because his pet boy and future son-in-law Kelly, played by Perry Lang, is the scientist who's experimenting on all these animals. So it's got the usual setup of kind of the authorities are hiding things. There's a cop trying to get things done. Jaws is definitely the template for this film, but it's definitely got its tongue in cheek. And it kind of works for me. It's one of those movies I love from VHS days. They had a really nice VHS cover for it back in the days of video rentals. The movie's got lots of little bits and pieces that really kind of work. Brock, the guy played by Henry Silver, and shout out to the Silver and Gold guys, by the way, is a lot of fun. He's almost like a kind of robot in a way. He flirts the most robotic kind of flirting with Robin Riker's character that is imaginable. He really is kind of doing it tongue totally in cheek. And I think he plays it just right for the tone of the movie. Now, Robert Forster's character, Dave, has got to play it straight because he's the straight man of the piece. And all of the other characters around him are, in a sense, there partly as comic relief and to be part of the joke. But as a central character, Dave Madison, the cop, has to be the straight man. He's the one that has to take it down the line. But I think that the movie makers realised they weren't going to be out-jawsing Jaws. And so having a lighter tone and having a kind of silliness about the movie and a gonzo sensibility really does make it work. And one of the things that makes it work and having that weird sensibility about it is, even though it's set in Chicago, it's filmed in Los Angeles. And in spite of the fact they put appropriate license plates on the cars, you can tell it's Los Angeles. You can see a whole bunch of the landscapes with the palm trees in the background. And I'm fairly sure last time I looked on anything, there weren't a lot of palm trees in Chicago, but there are a lot in LA. So it definitely plays against that. You get lots of little interesting set pieces in the movie as well. There's a bit where a mad bomber comes into the police station and is handled by Dave in a kind of weird way, and that comes in from left field. You get a gatekeeper at a wedding in the end of the movie, played by Mike Mazurki, in one of his last roles, but he's there playing a gatekeeper and, again, having the kind of right light touch for the piece. You get some nice interplay between Marissa, the character played by Robin Riker's mother, played by an actress called Patty Jerome, and Dave as well. He kind of goes to visit her and apologise for being a dickhead and meets her mother, and there's a kind of nicely weird little rapport between Marissa's mother, Mrs. Kendall, and Dave. There's just these little bits of the movie that you kind of like, and you like them in ways that enhance the experience a lot. And some of that's down to the actors, but also some of it's down to sales of script. But one way or the other, it gives a kind of lived-in feeling to the characters. Well, you do have the outrageous ones like Colonel Brock, played by Henry Silver. But in the core of things, Dave and Marissa and Chief Clark, played by Michael Gazzo, those ones kind of feel lived-in in a nice kind of way. It really does give us more than you expect from this kind of movie at this particular time period, being based a lot on the success of Jaws. A lot of these movies were shit, as Tentacles will tell you. There were so many of them that it's kind of ridiculous. But Alligator hits a sweet spot, not necessarily a high sweet spot, but it keeps us entertained. It keeps jumping with little bits of gonzo business in there. It doesn't take itself at all seriously. Some of the model work with the live, smaller alligators kind of works. The big robot alligator they have kind of works. In fact, it costs so much to make the big robot alligator, they didn't really want to blow it up. So there's a bit of a faked explosion to blow up the alligator at the end of the film. Spoiler alert. Oddly enough, one of the people who did the guts for that particular explosion, which you don't see much of in the film, it's like 2 seconds worth of shooting. But one of the people who made the guts and kind of helped set up the tiny exploding alligator that you get in the movie was a guy called Bryan Cranston, who has since gone on to success as an actor. Now, the director of the film was Lewis Teague, who isn't known for a lot of things. That's not a name that comes readily to mind as a film actor, as a film director, sorry. It's getting later at night. I apologise for this. But he has directed a few movies you might have seen and liked. He directed Cujo for a start, which is on everybody's list of one of the better Stephen King adaptations. He directed Jewel of the Nile. He directed another Stephen King adaptation, Cat's Eye, in 1985. And in 1991 did that weird Rutger Hauer movie Wedlock, which I think also had Mimi Rogers in it, if I remember rightly. And yes, I do. And Joan Chen. So there you go. How's that for remembering? He kind of petered out into TV work. He did a Duke of Hazzard reunion movie, a couple of episodes of Nash Bridges with Don Johnson in it. One episode of Time Tracks, which was a weird 1990s science fiction TV series filmed in Queensland, but apparently supposed to be in America. Man, I think the thing that killed his career was probably making Navy SEALs in 1990 with Charlie Sheen, Michael Biehn, and Bill Paxton. But Teague does a reasonable job in this one. I think that some of the editing could have been a bit better, but given the time constraints they probably had with making a movie at this kind of price level, I can understand why they didn't do a lot sharper editing. But I suppose it's no worse than a lot of other movies at the time. One of the other things, from a personal note, why films like Alligator really kind of work for me these days, and I'm fiddling around with things here, but I shouldn't be, is because back a number of years, I think about 8 years ago, I swam in a tank with a very large crocodile. It was about 800 kilos, and its name was Denzel for some reason. And they put you in a Perspex tube with holes drilled in the bottom so the water can get through. And then they dunk you like a tea bag into a tank in Darwin, along with various crocodiles at a place called Crocosaurus Cove in the middle of Darwin. And so you get to swim in a clear tank right next to an enormous ambush predator. And I did it because I'm a special breed of cat, a thrill seeker, which is a Chuck Connors reference that a lot of people won't get. But ever since I've done that, and it was a lot of fun to do, every time I see a crocodile or an alligator in a movie, I kind of flash back on me bashing on the side of the tank and splashing around trying to get the attention of a very large ambush predator with a head much larger than a Clydesdale horse's. So I think you should have as many life experiences as you can, because you're going to then get to appreciate a much wider range of movies at a deeper level than you would otherwise. So if you skydived, you'll enjoy Mission Impossible Fallout that much more. And if you jump between building and building and broken an ankle, you probably will as well. But I like Alligator. I watch it every few years for some reason. It's one of those movies that you kind of see, okay, I'm going to watch that again. And it does have that rewatchability, which is kind of an elusive quality for a lot of films. But it's one, when I find films that I do rewatch, I kind of appreciate without doing too deep an analysis on it, because I don't want to spoil the magic. but you should check out Alligator. There is a copy on YouTube. It's not necessarily the highest resolution, but I think you will be able to find a copy of it around somewhere if you look in a reasonable state. And you really should go back and just kind of grok that one again, because it is worth your attention. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about Runaway, a movie directed and written by Michael Crichton, who is a kind of problematic filmmaker in a lot of ways, and a problematic writer in some other ways, which I'll talk about as well. But I'll just play you the trailer for that and then start talking about 1980s ideas of the future, killer robots, and how Gene Simmons from KISS is a very one-note villain.
It is the future. Mysteriously spreading across an unsuspecting city, machines trained to serve humans are turning against them.
What do you got, Jerry?
Model 912 cut up two people inside the house.
I'm going in.
You're going in? We can send a disarm robot in.
It hit the floater, it'll hit the disarm, and any minute it's going to decide to hit the kid.
An ingenious conspiracy has begun. And someone has to stop the madman who started it all.
We've got a non-standard chip here. You can turn any domestic computer into a killing machine.
Working late at night all by yourself?
I just had a few things to finish up.
No,
no big deal.
I insist. Let me help you.
No.
Bug detected.
A lot of bugs, Jackie. I thought it was Queen.
Luther really wants to keep track of you. Why's that, Jackie?
This is a bad guy.
He's killed five so far. I want him.
I'm telling you, I can't go out there. I can't go out!
What does it take to get through to you? He sees everything. He knows everything that's going on in here.
You can't run away, Ramsey. My little machines will find you wherever you go.
Heard of a bullet that has your name on it? This isn't a runaway. This is murder.
We're never gonna make it through this one.
Runaway. Tom Selleck, Cynthia Rhodes, Gene Simmons. Runaway. TriStar Pictures.
For me, Michael Crichton's always been a problematic writer and filmmaker in a number of ways. He's a kind of science fiction. He was a kind of science fiction writer who didn't like science particularly. He always saw the negative side of things. He was really kind of a downer about it. He had doubts about progress and science. If you have a look through the movies, particularly that have been made based on his work, things like The Andromeda Strain, Westworld, Coma, Looker, Runaway, Jurassic Park, The 13th Warrior, and not necessarily 13th Warrior, what I'm talking about, Sphere, Congo, Terminal Man, all of those ones are about science going wrong. And he often got the science wrong when he was doing it as well. He's immensely popular, and a lot of his works are iconic. I mean, the Jurassic Park series, for instance, and Westworld, which has spun off into a very interesting HBO TV series, are great stuff. But toward the end of his career, he totally went off the reservation. There's a 2004 techno thriller he wrote, called State of Fear, which totally went against the idea of global warming. It's that global warming was this conspiracy of eco-terrorists and all sorts of things like that. So history isn't on the side of Michael Crichton. He died in 2008 of lymphoma, and so he's posthumous output, even though it hasn't disappeared, has been greatly reduced. But Crichton, I kind of never was in love with his work in a lot of ways, because even though he did make kind of techno science fiction works, he didn't have his heart in it from what I could see. It was a very kind of mechanistic approach he took to the subject matter. And he wasn't that good a writer. Yeah, he had the ideas, he had the high concepts. But in delivering them, he never really did it as well as people who had more of a love of science fiction as a genre and who were more in love with the science of it, even though he was a doctor. You never got the impression that he loved science in the way that a number of other hard science fiction writers of the time did. He really kind of had an anti-science bias, which was kind of off-putting for me because I'm an old-school science fiction reader. I think that if people of goodwill get together, they can fix things using the tools of technology. Michael Crichton didn't. He was one of those guys who was all about opening Pandora's box and all the things that come out of it, all the miseries and the evils of the world pouring forth from Pandora's box. He was one of those guys, too, that didn't remember the last thing that came out of Pandora's box. Hope. So, leaving aside that, I'm going to talk about this movie. So, the movie's set in the near future. It stars Thomas Selleck, Cynthia Rhodes, Gene Simmons, Kirstie Alley, and Stan Shaw. Music is interesting in this one, too. It's an electronic score by Jerry Goldsmith, which kind of works. It's got a very synthy 1980s feel about it, but in the context of this film, it does work. But anyway, back to the plot. Robots are commonplace in the near future. It's probably set about 1991 based on a couple of things we see on screens during the movie, and they are the low-res CRT screens we know and love from the 1980s. And robots are a household appliance in this near future. They're not particularly well-made. They're very boxy kind of things. With claws coming out of them, they really kind of, you know, the movie's limitations. It had $8 million budget, which wasn't fantastically large for the time. But all of the robots tended to be kind of boxy things with a claw sticking out of them, which is kind of interesting because at the start of the film, we see what the police squad, which is tasked with kind of going out there and stopping malfunctioning robots, of which there are a lot. And there's one in a cornfield, which is designed to go through cornfields and pick bugs off the leaves. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. First off, it's probably not the most efficient or cost-effective way of picking bugs off corn stalks. Two, the robots they use to do it are about a meter too short to pick bugs off the upper leaves of the corn when it grows to full height. So leaving that aside, there's a police squad that takes care of runaway robots. Now, the problem I've got with this, for starters, is if the robots are fucking up this much, surely it's a consumer affairs problem rather than a policing problem. And surely all the companies making robots would soon be bankrupt for the damage caused by their malfunctioning products. There's a consumer affairs aspect of this movie that's really not being at all addressed in order to get an action film going. So what I probably should do is go through the stuff that doesn't work in this movie first, and then I'll talk about the stuff that does. And there is some stuff that kind of works in this film, to give it reasonable credit. Things that don't work. Gene Simmons playing Dr. Charles Luther, the bad guy who has specialized computer chips that make robots go berserk. For a start, it's an underwritten character, and a lot of it relies on Gene Simmons' persona as a member of KISS and these kind of saturnine looks. Not a particularly gifted actor. I mean, he may be okay as a musician. That's for other people to say. Maybe Morris has an opinion on that. But as an actor, he kind of doesn't work. He's very kind of one-note villain. And his motivation is severely lacking. They just say he's a madman and he wants to tear things down. That can work if you've got Heath Ledger playing the Joker. Doesn't work in this case because it's underwritten. We don't understand anything about it except the fact that he's a nutcase who wants these computer chips that are being made that he has had programmed to make robots into killing machines. That's it. We don't know why he wants that, apart from the easy kind of hand-wavy thing of him being a nutcase. Villain doesn't work. That's one thing I don't like about the film. The other thing I don't like about the film is Joey Kramer, the actor playing Sergeant Jack Ramsey, Tom Selleck's character's son. He's fucking annoying. We only get a prolonged dialogue scene with him once during the film at the start where he meets his father's new partner, Karen Thompson, played by Cynthia Rhodes. And the kid is so ebullient and one-note joyous child. It is frustratingly annoying. He is the kind of kid who, as the Germans say, has a face meant to be punched. though I don't advocate violence against children based on my own history. But, yeah, he's a character that it's hard to warm to be really honest. And when he is ultimately and inevitably threatened by Charles Luther, because the kid is such an obnoxiously cheerful kid, there's not much at stake there from an audience's point of view. So I don't like that part. In the creation of a world where robots malfunction on such a regular basis that you need police, well-financed police sections to handle malfunctioning robots is a bit of an ask. I mean, these robots have a certain level of AI to them. Lois, the robot that runs Jack Ramsey's household, seems to have a certain level of smarts, about the equivalent, with maybe a tweak or two more, of an Alexa or a Google Home, which of course has all of the hardware somewhere else rather than on the unit itself. So all of that kind of stuff is problematic. And also the fact that it seems to be that in this world, robots are run purely by hardware and not by software. It's computer chips that are required to make them malfunction rather than a computer virus, which people were aware of very much in 1985. I remember myself that was beginning to become an issue, and software was such an important part of things. But these robots all seem to be hardwired rather than having upgradable firmware and things like that, or even just a hard drive with software running on it. So in that sense, the movie doesn't predict the future. It also doesn't predict the present as it was in 1984 with much veracity at all. Now let's get on to the stuff I do like in this. There's some nice software ideas. There's some nice ideas in this one. There's a computer system that the cops have in the cop cars that can identify the gun from the sound it makes when it goes off. So that's pretty nice looking software. It forms a kind of pattern and decides what kind of gun is being used. And there's a scene in the movie where a household robot goes berserk in the household of a character played by Chris Mulkey, who was in Twin Peaks, I think. So there's that, which is kind of thinking ahead and kind of nice use of software for police work. There are also video drones. They're kind of triangular and they've got a central fan in them, but they're like drones as we have them now. Though these days we'd have a quadricopter and they're a lot noisier than what they call floaters in this movie. And but still the concept's there for a drone. These ones, though, have very low-res cameras, kind of VHS, bad VHS definition cameras. And nonetheless, they are drones as we know them. They can be guided through the air fairly accurately and are used in police work inside structures. Though I've never seen a drone used in a house where it didn't prang into a wall. So maybe their software is better than ours and their stabilizers are better than ours. But the concept's there. There's actually a list on IMDb of the things that this movie gets right as far as the future is concerned. Domestic robots, video mail, social media. There is a bit of a social media thing with Jack Ramsey on it. The internet to a certain extent. Voice-activated computers, biometric security via retinal identification. Camera drones, tablet PCs. There is actually a tablet PC in this film, which is used as an identikit by one of the police officers on a crime scene. And even though it was a one-purpose tablet and it was kind of chunky and about the size of a pizza box, it still had the basic concept there, which was kind of cool. There were wireless headsets and police officers using semi-automatic pistols as sidearms, because in 1984, most cops used revolvers. So they got that kind of stuff right, or at least predicted right, which is not too bad a score for a kind of action film in the 1980s. It's a lot higher than a lot of other films. Now, there's a few things about this film. There is a piece of gratuitous nudity in a hotel room, which is a bit surprising and a little bit out of the norm for this film, which doesn't have a lot of swearing and it doesn't have a lot of other sexualization. But there is a topless scene with a woman in a hotel room, which is kind of pointless. I don't mind a bit of gratuitous nudity as long as it's kind of in context and in tune with the rest of the movie, but this one definitely isn't. And apparently this was one of the favourite films of the Romanian dictator, Nicolae Ceaușescu, which is a kind of a bit odd in a way. I'm not sure what it was about it that Ceausescu liked, but during his trial in 1989, after which he was executed, Ceausescu mentioned Tom Selleck's name and his character in the movie several times during his trial, which is kind of weirdly fucked up. One of the other things in this movie that I found really weird is there's a robot Japanese food stall on the side of the road, which is kind of silly, and it gives him, Jack Ramsey orders California rolls, and it delivers California rolls in a little bento box. And I was kind of thinking, because I've been watching a lot of Japanese YouTube videos, as I mentioned before, why the fuck they didn't just have a vending machine there? It was totally pointless to have a kind of robot voice-operated Japanese food stall when you could have a vending machine do the job just as easily, if not more so. One of the other things I found out while I was doing the research for this one was that Joey Kramer, the actor who plays the obnoxious child in the movie, in 2016, on May the 1st, he was arrested by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police just outside Vancouver in relation to a robbery that occurred on the 28th at a bank. So the kid grew up to be a bank robber. Now, I know it's difficult being a child actor, and I know there are possible abuse issues, which the two Coreys, of course, have alluded to in various times. But that was a bit of a surprise. But there are a couple other bits I like. There's a female foreman on a building site, which I kind of liked, and it was a deliberate choice made, even though she does say that her insurance doesn't cover turning off a malfunctioning construction robot. I would have thought that it'd be the first thing you'd want to get covered by insurance, particularly on a building site where robots are working alongside human beings. And none of the important things about it, or any of this, gets addressed, like how many human beings they had to lay off in order to get construction robots in there, whether it ended up being cost effective, and whether the idea of malfunctioning robots on a construction site building a high-rise building was a good thing. If they were going to fuck up as often as they clearly did, I'm not sure I'd want them to build a building I was going to go into. And yes, I'm getting analytical with this movie. So that was there. The other use of drones they have in this movie, which is kind of cool, is that Charles Luther, the evil Gene Simmons character, uses drones to deliver tear gas. They've got tear gas canisters built into them, his drones. They hide up in the corner of the ceiling above the door, and when the cops come through, lower down and start squirting tear gas everywhere. That's kind of cool. There is the other weird out-of-tone thing about this movie is there's a scene where Jack Ramsey consults a clairvoyant in the police station. Clearly she's at somebody hired by the police department to be a clairvoyant. And she gives him some kind of vague, hand-wavy advice, foreshadowing bits of the plot. But it doesn't play well to a 21st century audience when we know that all clairvoyants are shysters and hucksters and people not to be trusted one tiny bit. And if you don't know that, you probably should. We get the usual kind of police stuff where Tom Selleck's trying to track down Luther and the chips that he has. Luther wants the templates for the chips, which Tom Selleck's character gets off Kirstie Alley's character, who is one of the confederates and girlfriend of Charles Luther. Her name's Jackie Rogers. This is young, attractive Kirstie Alley, as opposed to the troubled person she became later. And she's in there basically to be the equivalent of the bad Bond girl, where she has a certain plot function to fulfill and then ends up being killed by the bad guy. So that's pretty much her function in the movie, which is kind of, you know, very much of its time and doesn't play well to our 21st century sensibilities in a lot of ways. There are a couple of other bits which are kind of interesting in this flick. There are also some remote control vehicle drones, which are kind of little flat vehicles that zip through traffic and are used as improvised explosive devices. They're basically mobile landmines, which is a technology that has some quite frightening military applications, though it's pretty much obvious from the way the film plays out that these are inventions of Charles Luther, even though the cop car is set up to combat it with lasers sitting on top of the cop car and a grid which gives a visual representation of where the attack's coming from. So we live in a world not only of malfunctioning robots, but where kind of killer street drones are common enough that the cops have countermeasures for them. It's getting to be a very dystopian kind of world in this movie. We also get a little nod to the classic Hitchcock film Vertigo, in the fact that Ramsey, the Tom Selleck character, has a fear of heights, kind of like Scotty in Vertigo, another cop who has a fear of heights. It's done so that it adds tension to one of the climactic scenes, which takes place in a high-rise building being constructed. But the other thing is that one of the other minions that the evil Luther has, and the name Luther is borrowed from Superman, as we all know, are little spider robots with big injecting needles in it, which they can inject poison into, and then they explode. So basically they can inject acid into their victims, and then they explode and set them on fire, which is visually very interesting. But the spider robots are a little bit kind of toy-like. They are a mechanical special effect, so it's not like they use primitive CG or something like that, which they probably didn't have very much of at the time to portray the robots. But the spider robots are kind of cool. They climb. They do seem to have quite an effective AI in the fact that they can maneuver around obstacles and climb over open elevator cages and find ways to get at the people they're intended to attack. So they're kind of cool in there as well. The other thing we have is a special kind of bullet, which is basically a miniaturized cruise missile, where it's aimed at the heat signature of a particular person, and it'll follow it around corners, up and down hills, and through narrow pipes to get to these people. They're very an interesting technology, and again, it's a technology that has such scary military applications that really, you know, it's there's some really dangerous technologies in this film which are not recognized particularly effectively as a dangerous technology. And not only is Charles Luther a computer scientist, he's also a military missile expert and good at miniaturizing other technologies as well. So he's a bit of a scientific polymath, and that's a little bit OTT, given the fact that he's got the social skills of a toad, and he's obviously abusive to his girlfriend, played by the Kirstie Alley character. But the cops don't seem to care about that. All they care about is the fact that she can help them with finding out things they need to know about Luther. So there's not that kind of recognition of her status as a human being and her rights as a human being. She's pushed around a lot by the cops, which is crazily odd. The 1980s, there are movies like this that kind of work, but there are also movies that maybe we need to look at in context of the writer-director of the films and what the writer-director thinks is acceptable. And there are some things in here that really don't do that. Now, having said that, the relationship between Karen Thompson and Tom Selleck's character, Cynthia Rose and Tom Selleck's character, Jack Ramsey and Karen Thompson, is kind of cute. There's a nice chemistry between them. Cynthia Rhodes is quite good as Karen, even though her role essentially is to be the rookie partner and also the love interest to Ramsey, and that's a function that's all too common in 1980s action films of various types. But I think Cynthia Rhodes, who later married the singer Richard Marx and had three kids with him, they broke up in 2014. She left to kind of raise a family, but I think that her acting in this, if you watch it fairly closely, is quite effective. I think that had she not chosen one life path, I think her abilities as an actor were sufficient that her career could have gone places, as indeed did Kirstie Alley's. We also get a number of other people. We get G.W. Bailey playing the chief of police. He's known for having played one of the police chiefs, unfortunately, in the Police Academy movies, which may have kind of stereotyped him. We get Stan Shaw playing one of the computer technicians in there. Stan Shaw, an actor of colour that I really like. I've seen him in a lot of things, and he's one of those guys who's in the background in a lot of good movies and does a very, very effective job, but didn't really, for various reasons, and some of which may have been to do with him being a person of color really didn't get the breaks that somebody else might have who was not black. He's in there as well. I kind of like him in that. So overall, the movie's a very much a mixed bag. It works as a techno thriller at a certain level, but in combination with another movie made in the 1980s by Michael Crichton, Looker, the sexual politics and some of the implications of the technologies and the way technology is used are very problematic, and that's a consistent factor in many of the works of Michael Crichton, who I think, given that he does have an important place in science fiction movie history based on The Andromeda Strain and Westworld and Jurassic Park, really, I can't find much love in my heart for the man and his works, because he has an attitude to a genre I love that I find very antithetical to my own. But anyway, I'm kind of winded up there. I think Runaway is another movie that you can watch and enjoy, but you have to take into account the weird things in there where, even at the time it was made, and I'm very aware that it was in 1984 and I've got a lot of hindsight there, there are some things that weren't particularly well thought out from a science fictional viewpoint, which could have been and would have enhanced the films had they been. But anyway, that's about it this time around. It's time to knock, knock, knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go. Thank you for listening. I'm going to be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I may well do some Japanese films in that. Who knows? It's a mystery. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast, where I may well also do some Japanese films. I may do a Japanese film festival on both of the podcasts, if I can get myself organized enough. So anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. Watch some good films, watch some bad films. Keep watching the skies. Send me a like on Facebook if you want to, and have a bit of a chat about these movies with me on Facebook. If you like, that seems to work better these days than using email on the feedbackpaleo@gmail.com. I'll keep that open, but I'm not getting much love there. You can also support the podcast, of course, as indeed a number of other wonderful people have, via patreon.com/paleocinema. So anyway, take care of yourselves. And again, thank you to David Kummer for supporting us via Patreon. Here, of course, are the credits to the podcast in the style of movie credits to honor the Patreon supporters. I'll see you later, and look after yourselves. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the Technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.